Thank you, children. Our scripture text this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, right in the middle, chapter 8, verses 34 through 37. Jesus called the crowd with his disciples, and he said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life?" Seeing as today is the day that we recognize and celebrate and honor our graduates, and we send them out into the real world, as we are wont to say, I thought it might be beneficial to share my first adventure into the real world, my first full-time job outside of college. And that job was construction. I was a construction worker. And I know that my impressive musculature and my just stereotypical masculine way of relating to the world around me, you may think that the construction world was easy for me. It was indeed not. I was hired for a company to do drywall. They were making trailers for FEMA in light of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. They had a contract with the government in addition to their regular workload. So essentially, their output had doubled. They needed new staff to come in and frantically make these new trailers. Now, that made the work environment very, very tense. Output had to be very high. People had to be on top. People were upset with one another. But the work was easy. I had done drywall before. It was not that challenging. What made things difficult, and this is true of any job, what can make or break a work environment is your coworkers, right? And this situation was no different. On my very first day, my coworkers told me to watch out for one person in particular. This man was large. He had a temper. He was very mean. He had been to prison for violent crimes. And his go-to motivational phrase when dealing with conflict was, "I'm not afraid to go back to prison." Now, wait. So, now work was hectic. And in this environment, making these trailers, if one department got behind, all departments got behind. So, for example, if the electricians running the wires behind the 2x4s, if they got behind, I couldn't put up my drywall, so I got behind. After me, the people putting up molding and trim, they couldn't do their job, they got behind. Then carpets, then finishes, all the way down. So constantly, these different departments of people were yelling and screaming at one another, "Hurry up, do your job, you're making me behind." There was fighting all day long. I found out on my very first day that this gentleman I was warned about that was not afraid to go back to prison was the person right behind me. And I found this out when I got behind on my first day. It was, after all, my first day. And I heard a gentleman enter the trailer, and the trailer shook. And he saw me in there, which meant that I was behind, and he was going to be behind. He expressed his disappointment at this reality with some colorful language that I will not repeat here, but I got the message loud and clear. And from that day on, I was motivated by fear to work as quickly and efficiently as I could. But inevitably, there came a day when I was hopelessly behind. I kept hearing that phrase in my head, "I'm not afraid to go back to prison," and the language that I won't repeat here, I heard that too. I worked frantically, which caused me to make mistakes, which caused me to work more frantically, which caused me to make more mistakes, and before I know it, I was extremely far behind. And I heard those telltale footsteps enter my trailer, and the trailer shook. But there was no outburst, there was no language, and I thought maybe this guy sees how hard I'm working, and how fast I'm working, and he's giving me a break. Or maybe he's just having a great day and he's being extra forgiving. Whatever reason, I'm not gonna give up this opportunity. I continued to work quickly. I was panicking, I was trying to get my work done, I was frantic. I was snapped out of my panic when I felt my collar tighten around my neck. And then I was lifted off the ground and slowly turned around face to face with this gentleman. Now, before I describe what happened next, spoiler alert, I lived. So I began to panic, and in a kind of a survival mode, my brain went through my options. Number one, I can fight this guy. Yeah, if you've ever had one part of your brain suggest an idea, and another part immediately dismiss that idea in a humorous way, that happened. Second option, maybe I can talk my way out of this. You know, I'm good with words. I'm known for making people laugh. Maybe I can tickle them or something and talk my way out of it. Third idea was kind of a compromise between the first two. Maybe I could not fully talk my way out of this, but ask him to beat me on the ground so I can lay in the fetal position and cover my vital organs, you know, my brain. And then the best idea came last, as they often do. I thought about my coworkers. Remember, coworkers can make or break a work environment. I thought I'll cry for help, and my coworkers will band together with me, and we'll end this bully's reign of terror once and for all. It was at the same time that I had that thought that I noticed my coworkers were already in the trailer with us, and they had formed a tight circle around the two of us, and they were pointing at me and laughing. It was at that moment I realized they were not my friends. They were there for the show. And I knew I was going to encounter some physical pain, but now I had the emotional pain of no one was my friend, I was alone, I was betrayed. And just the emotional and the physical impending doom, I began to panic, I tensed up. I was probably the scariest I've ever been in my life. And I closed my eyes, and as I was tense, in my panic and in my fear, I heard a gentle and quiet voice, almost whisper-like, say to me, "Danny, I'm not going to hurt you. I've never been to prison. We've all been messing with you." And then he set me down, and obviously a wave of feelings came over, relief right away. But if you've ever been so relieved, it makes you angry that you were so scared to begin with. But then he was huge, so I couldn't say anything. And then I was impressed that he got me so good, and we became fast friends over that alone. We had lunch together every day after that. It's always nice, at least in that work environment, to be friends with the biggest guy. And yeah, we would have lunch together, we would talk about stuff. I found out quickly, it kind of became an inside joke. I could insult this guy right to his face if I used puns. English was not his first language. And puns require that you know multiple definitions of a singular word or multiple words that sound similar. So if I used puns, I could insult him to his face and he'd have no idea. He would then go home and look up what I had said and come back the next day and say, "Good one, Danny," and then he'd smack me in the back of the head. But we had a conversation one day at lunch, as we often did, and it was really simple, kind of shoot in the breeze, small talk thing, but it has had an effect on me until this day. We were talking about what our previous jobs were. He asked me what I did, and I said, I worked for the admissions department at my college, and I told him, you know, what that entailed. And then, of course, I asked him, you know, what did you do? And he said, I picked strawberries. And I made some dismissive comment about, it doesn't sound like fun, or that's not a great career, or something like that. And he said some very simple words that still ring true today. He said, "Well, it was a job." And I realized in that moment, and I was preparing to go to seminary, by the way, how privileged it is, and in many ways, how selfish it is to desire meaning and fulfillment from work. Is this work fulfilling? Is this job have to serve a greater purpose? That's really a privileged place and sometimes a selfish place to be when there are people who just want a job to keep them off the streets. Or they just want a pay raise so they can afford insurance for their children. Or they just want to feed their family. And I still think about that today as I struggle with meaning and fulfillment in work. It is a dangerous thing to tie our meaning and value to our work. And I say that to our graduates who are looking at careers as we go out and to everyone else. It is a deadly and dangerous thing to find meaning and fulfillment in our work. And to that end, I would make two statements. Jesus was not a hard worker. And Jesus was not a high achiever. I don't say those statements to artificially create controversy and make you pay attention. Pro tip, by the way, if you offend people at the beginning of a sermon, they usually listen for the rest of it. I don't say that to create controversy or to be divisive, but if that is odd to hear, maybe we should re-examine our relationship to work. Now, there's lots of evidence in the New Testament that Jesus was not a hard worker. and a high achiever. We mentioned in the children's moment last week his frequent practice of withdrawing from the crowds, pressing pause on whatever he was doing and leaving. And not only was that a part of his ministry, it's how he began his ministry. In the passage that the kids read this morning, Jesus is baptized, the voice from heaven, the dove, all that great stuff, the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The first thing he does when he begins his ministry is then go take 40 days away. We know in his teachings, some that were also read this morning, work is often diminished in value. In the parable of the prodigal son, you have an older son, and the way the Bible phrases it, he claims he has worked like a slave for his father, worked tirelessly for years, done everything right. Then you have another son who takes money that he does not deserve or earn and goes and wastes it. Who is the bad guy of that story? It's the hardworking son. In the parable of the workers in the vineyard, you have those who work all day and those who work an hour, and they all get paid the same. Who are the ones that need a lecture and a reminder of what true value is? It's the hard workers. We know that Jesus did not support himself in his ministry. He relied on the support of others. And in Luke 8, we get the detail that a large group of women supported him. In his day, not working and being supported by women would have been the ultimate dismissal of the value of work. Now, there are lots of other more direct indications of the way Jesus diminished the value of work in the Gospels. But the most telling to me is one that is very subtle, but significant. The Gospel writers give us these little narrative clues when they talk about the things Jesus said and did. On the way to blank, Jesus. While passing through blank, Jesus. Inevitably, Jesus notices someone. Or he has stopped and someone asks him a question. Or someone asks for healing. All of these moments where Jesus heals and teaches and has compassion, these were not in his original plan. He was passing through somewhere, going somewhere else, and he pressed pause on his plans to heal and to teach and to be compassion. If you think of all the greatest stories of Jesus that we sing about and that we study, maybe there are life verses and things that we pray. Most of those would not have happened if Jesus was not willing to be interrupted. That does not sound like a hard worker to me, at least the way that we define it in America. Hard workers and high achievers get things done no matter what the cost. They are laser focused. They keep their eyes on the prize. No matter what, that is what is important. And that is not the life that Jesus modeled for us. We have this great text this morning that comes in the middle of the Gospel of Mark. And by the way, if you've never read a gospel all the way through, Mark is a great place to start. It's the shortest, 16 chapters. It's no fluff, no filler. Mark tells you everything you need to know, nothing you don't. Even the Christmas story didn't make the cut. No time for babies, right? So there's 16 chapters, and what we read here comes in chapter 8, the very middle of the gospel. And Mark is really kind of cool the way he writes things, that the first 8 chapters, you get to know Jesus, right? Who this guy is. And the second 8 chapters, you see what he does. In the first 8 chapters, we get a pause here at chapter 8. And Jesus asks a question. We didn't read it, but he asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And that's a question for his disciples. It's also a question for the reader. All right, you've read half the story. What do you think of this guy? So the teachings here are very important moving forward. And he gives us these very important words here. "For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life?" That is a key passage as Jesus moves forward and teaches. One of the most dangerous things we can do to the teachings of Jesus is to over-spiritualize them. Some translations read this, "forfeit their soul." To me, that conjures up this idea of selling your soul to the devil in exchange for power or money or influence or all those things. That's often how we read this verse here. It's this eternal kind of idea. I don't think that's what Jesus had in mind. I think he had a much more grounded and earthly, real-world kind of idea, because I think I've experienced it myself. If we look at the rich and the famous in our world, the powerful, the influencers, their lives are not spared from the problems the rest of us experience. If anything, wealth and fame and power creates problems. The rich and the famous in our world, their lives are plagued with divorce and addiction, personal problems, conflict. It was the great prophet who said, "Mo money, mo problems." That's Tupac, by the way. A person we don't often think of wisdom, Jim Carrey, said, "I wish that everyone could get rich and famous and have all their wildest dreams come true so they could see that it's not the answer. What good does it give for a person to gain the whole world and yet lose their life?" I did campus ministry at a university for a few years, and this university prided itself on having the best and the brightest students. Different departments from the university would come and speak to the campus ministry staff, and someone from career services to this place talked to us and said, "Our students are the best of the best. Not only do they go out and be the top in their fields, they go on to create fields that don't exist yet. So, if you're a part of this university and you graduate and you go on to become the world's best doctor, it's not good enough because you didn't invent a kind of medicine that didn't exist previously. These students are the ultimate high achievers, and the university brags on them constantly. What they don't share as much is that this university consistently leads the nation in unhealthy drinking behaviors among freshmen. What that means is students blacking out and waking up and not knowing where they are. Romantic encounters with people that they don't even know the first name. Drinking alone, frequent trips to the emergency room. This university consistently leads the nation in that kind of thing among their freshmen. The campus administrators and I would often get together and talk about, you know, why do we experience this thing among our students? Why are they stressed out? Why are they acting in this way? And the prevailing thought among ministers much wiser than myself was that these students were the best of the best in their high schools. They were the valedictorians, the high achievers, the top. Then they came to a university where everyone had done that. And for the first time in their life, they weren't number one, they were average. And they didn't know how to be average. It freaked them out, and they self-medicated. What good is it to gain the whole world and yet lose your life? And lastly, I think I've experienced this in my own life personally. I know of a father who was a very successful doctor and was wealthy because of it. But his busy work schedule, his stress, his lack of availability caused him to lose his family and to create a rift between him and his son that may never be healed. What good is it to gain the whole world and yet you lose your life? Now, don't hear me say with all this that work is bad or achievement is bad. They are not. The great gift of our faith is that it gives us perspective. We can see things in their proper place, see them as the way Jesus would see them. I'm not good at wrapping up sermons. If this were youth, I'd say, all right, let's eat some hot dogs, and that'd be then. But so I want to share some wisdom from some people wiser than myself on this. I've read a couple of these quotes in many of our graduate recognition Sundays, but they still ring true. The first one deals with raising children to care for others, to identify with the needs of others, as was mentioned in our children's moment this morning. This comes from Richard Foster. Our children need to join us in this ministry of identification. We do them no favor by shielding them from suffering and need. If we imprison them in ghettos of affluence, how can they learn compassion for the broken of the world? So let us walk hand in hand with our children into pockets of misery and suffering. One specific means of identification with the poor is discovered in our approach to education. Do we see a college education, for example, as a ticket to privilege or as a training ground to service the world? What do we teach our teenagers in this matter? Do we urge them to enter college because it will better equip them to serve others? Or do we bribe them with promises of future status and salary increases? No wonder they graduate more deeply concerned about their standard of living than about suffering humanity. The second quote comes from Mark Iaconelli. Anxious expectations are grounded in the fear of failure. They are nurtured by the belief that our accomplishments determine our value and worth. This is the message in our secular culture, and this is frequently the driving force within most Christians. But is there anything more destructive than human beings who believe they have life under control? Under this illusion, we assume that our every fortune is earned and our every suffering deserved. Before I read this last one, let me wrap up here. This comes from a YouTuber. It's a YouTuber that my children love. It's an educational channel. It's science-based, but it's one of those things where you learn science, but you get to see things blown up. So I'm fine with him watching it a lot. The YouTuber is Mark Rober. He is a former NASA employee who left to start a YouTube channel. And he does all kinds of science experiments. It's really educational. It's really, really cool. But in a video that was a break from his normal routine, he talked about his son. And he mentioned that he's always been hesitant to talk about his son on his YouTube channel because the internet is a cruel, cruel place. His son has a developmental disability and a special need, but he describes his son as having a superpower, a very unique superpower, and that is whenever someone comes to the house and he meets a person for the first time, the son immediately goes to his room, takes a big piece of paper, draws some art, and on the reverse side writes a nice personal and encouraging letter. He does that for everyone that he meets. The works of art are not great, the letter is not poetic, but the personal letter from a new friend is a missed thing in our very disconnected world. This is a unique superpower that his son has. This is how he describes the value of his son. My son will never be the star of his Little League team. He won't be the first person to set foot on Mars, nor will he invent the cure to cancer. But by the best definition I can think of, he and his special needs buddies and everyone else out there like them are giants living amongst us mere mortals. They make the world a better place, and we are lucky to have them. Work is not a bad thing, and achieving great things is not a great thing, not a bad thing. I'm thankful when I have to go to the doctor. I hope my doctor studied hard, and my children as well. I'm thankful this building is standing and secured by people who know what they're doing when they built it. But we need to put it in its proper place. When work and achievement is where we find our ultimate value, it is impossible to see ourselves and others the way that God sees us. So students and everyone else listening, work hard, achieve great things, but know that it's not the ultimate good in the world. Your value is in who you were created to be. And in the Bibles that you'll get later in this service, or after this service, many of people who have loved you and cared for you over the years of this church have wrote your real value in there and pointed out through scripture. So work hard, do great things, but that's not where your value comes from. What good is it to gain the whole world and yet lose your life? Amen. Nyssa is going to come lead us now. We come to the time in our service when we give our tithes and offerings to support the missions and ministry of this church. There are instructions in your bulletin. We encourage you to give.